This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, black Republicans try to woo the former head of the NAACP, and anti-Bush rhetoric gets a worldwide audience at the UN this week. Joining us today from our NPR headquarters in Washington is Joe Davidson, an editor at The Washington Post. At member station WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island, Glenn Lowry, professor of social sciences and professor of economics at Brown University. And by phone, we've got Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you all for joining us. And I hope that you were all listening to our little discussion with Howard Dean, head of the Democratic Party, and Tara Wall, who's an outreach director for the Republican Party. I want to go to a kind of interesting twist on all of the partisan politics. Black Republican groups made an appeal this week to persuade African-American voters to support Maryland Lieutenant Governor Michael Steele's bid for the U.S. Senate. He's African-American. He's a former monk. He has all sorts of interesting bits in his resume. But they're trying to reach Kwesi Mfume, who just lost in his bid for the Senate, to be Steele's challenger. And the appeal is based on race. It says African-Americans should unify and support the black candidate. Professor Berry, what do you think about that?
Well, here's what I think, Farai. I think that, first of all, it was interesting. The Republican Party's approach is to focus simply on the color of whoever it is, and blacks should vote for them. And one example of how they operate is the choice of who to put on the air. I mean, for the Democrats, you have Howard Dean. For the Republicans, they have, and people can pick anybody they want to, and they have all kinds of people in the Republican National Committee. They go directly to the person who's the African-American outreach, which tells you their thinking, the picking of candidates, what the candidates stand for. If black voters do vote for Michael Steele in Maryland, it will be because he's black. I don't know if that'll work, because blacks supported Clarence Thomas when he was up for the Supreme Court, and most of them did it, even though they didn't agree with anything he stood for, because he was black and they wanted another black person on the Supreme Court. So I don't know how far we've gotten away from the idea of we will just focus on, boy, we'd like to have some more black people or not, but we're going to find out in this race. But I'd be surprised if Mfume does support a Steele, since they differ philosophically, and I don't think he will do it. Mfume will make his decision simply based on race, and he's known Cardin a long time, and they get along, and they stand almost in the same position on almost every issue you can think of.
You're talking about the difference between issue-based thinking and skin color-based thinking. How does that parse out, do you think, when people make decisions? I mean, is one more important than the other?
Well, in fact, we've seen, and I've been watching this a long time, as I pointed out the Clarence Thomas example, the Condi Rice example. Many black people don't like politically where the administration stands and what Ms. Rice has to represent. But most black people that I know say, well, it's nice to have a black person in that job. Somebody has to do that job, and it's first time, and she's articulate and whatever, so we're happy to have her there. What the decisions we make and that blacks make in this election will tell us how far we've come from simply saying we're going to pay attention to we need more black folks, just as women do, for example, when they say, well, we need more women doing that without regard to what they're doing and whether they're concerned, more concerned about issues. I have a hunch, though, that we've moved so far that people will make their judgments based on where people stand. They've had too many examples of how Clarence Thomas turned out in the end, and there were people who had supported him, and then when he decided things, they said they were sorry and they didn't understand that. So we'll see, but I bet that they will vote for Cardin.
You know, Joe, you're an editor at the Washington Post. This is kind of your turf, a race like this. What do you see or what do you hear in terms of the Cardin Steele race and how African Americans are going to make their choices?
Well, I think one interesting thing about this this organization of black Republicans that is trying to get Kwesi Mfume to back Steele is that they produced a radio ad which was designed presumably to secure black votes for the Republican candidate. That ad said, among other things, that Martin Luther King was a Republican, and this is something that that historians have said there's absolutely no evidence for. He did not endorse any candidate. They've also used they also tried to link Democrats to the Ku Klux Klan and other things like that. And I think that this ad, if an example of their strategy, it seems to have backfired, because even Michael Steele issued a statement yesterday basically denouncing the ad, saying that the kind of slash-and-burn partisan politics, as he called it, has no place in American politics, even though he said the group might have had good intentions. And so I think that this is kind of a tale of how not to approach the black voter. And I think that if you want to attach, if a black Republican wants to attract a black voter, that candidate actually needs to go about it in somewhat the way Steele is doing it, and that's not to play up his Republican ties. Steele's ads that are running in the Washington metropolitan area, as well as across, which of course includes the Maryland suburbs, and across the state, makes no mention of the fact that he's a Republican. And he's doing this not just to attract black voters, but he's doing it because Maryland is basically a Democratic state. But he shows, I think, and his ads, by the way, are very polished, very, very well done ads. And it's quite the contrast to a much more, I guess I could call it ham-handed approach to trying to say King was a Republican, Democrats or Ku Klux Klan members or were. That's simply going to turn off the black community.
Professor Glenn Lowry, there's a lot of issues on the table when it comes to recruiting the black vote. It's not just skin color, it's also about moral values. And recently there was a story that came out that said that only 2.6% of black churches received funds from the administration's faith-based and community initiative. And the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies conducted the study, said that it's because a lot of black churches don't really have the resources to apply for grants. Now, when you come down to one of these, you know, one of the bridges between the Republican Party and African Americans has been this appeal to, we have the same moral values. Certainly, there is some evidence of conservative values, social values in the black community. Do you think that kind of where the money is flowing will have any impact on this race?
No, I don't. I think we have to keep our eye on the ball here. I mean, you know, there's a distinction between politics, which is about how the country is going to be governed, what the major policies are going to be. Are we going to have health care for people who need it? Are taxes going to be cut, or are they going to be raised to provide social benefits and the rest? And then there's being proud of an African-American who has made it in life. You know, Condoleezza Rice, God bless her, or Michael Steele, for that matter. What the Republican Party stands for, all you have to do is look at their coalition. Look how they get themselves elected around the country. Gun lobbies, anti-tax, Christian right. Not that African-Americans are not Christians, but I'm saying the policies that they have been following at the national and at the local level have definitely been deleterious to the interests of African-American people. I'm talking about the death penalty. Who gets executed in this country? The jails are overflowing with young black men in this country. We've basically given up on helping people in terms of any kind of long-term commitment to income support. Those are the issues that really matter. And for African-Americans, there can be no doubt but that the ideology of the Republican Party is not in our interest. And therefore, when some black Republicans get the assignment of ginning up the black vote for their candidates, they can't do anything else but make these silly appeals to some kind of racial loyalty, which really hasn't got anything to do with anybody's bottom line.
Glenn, let me just ask you a personal question. You were a conservative and then became, I don't even know what you would call yourself now, a liberal, libertarian, free thinker, whatever you want to call yourself. How did you think before about these issues?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked me that. I mean, even though the show was not about me, but I'll just take this moment to say, I was on this moral trip. It was about unwed babies, and it was about black on black crime, and it was about how come our kids can't study harder, and why can't we help ourselves? Well, of course, we can help ourselves, and that's true. But that, in my past, I think I exaggerated way out of proportion relative to the kinds of things that I was just saying, which is what politics is about. And the problem here is that the moral conversation is really a private African-American communal civic kind of conversation. It should be in a church basement in front of a microphone talking to America We should be talking about our common public life. And I just woke up to that sometime in the mid-1990s. And look what these conservatives and neoconservatives have wrought. I mean, I'm lucky I jumped the ship before these guys sailed off to Iraq.
And Farai, in fact, Lowry and I had some exchanges during that period.
We did.
And I used to try to tell him, but he wouldn't pay any attention to me, that it was an old-and problem, not an either-or problem.
It probably sunk in when he wasn't even, you know, thinking about it.
Yeah.
You planted a seed, Mary.
Yeah, and then the other thing is I wanted to point out is as I go around the country, when I speak anywhere, Republicans send somebody, and they have that whole bunch of leaflets to hand out with that same argument about how Lincoln was a party of blacks and freed us and the Klan did this. They hand that out. That's their message everywhere. And then they have one other argument. We're the moral party, and we're against same-sex marriage. And then they make these two arguments, and we have black candidates, and then they sit down. So wherever you go in the country where you find people campaigning, that's what you hear them say.
But, you know, and on this point of black candidates, Tyrell Walden talked about the black candidates running for statewide office in Ohio and Pennsylvania and Maryland and how the Republican Party is trying to recruit candidates. You know, the Joint Center in another report, and by full disclosure, let me add that I once worked for the Joint Center. It said that this year there are only seven black Republicans running for Congress, and that's down from a high of 24 in 1994. So why this drastic decline if the Republican Party is really out there trying to recruit black candidates as it claims?
Well, we'll see what happens with the three candidates who are still in the game. But I want to turn to the United Nations. It's kind of like, you know, 4th of July, a lot of fireworks. First, the president of Iran told the General Assembly by causing war and conflict, some are fast expanding their domination. And then President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela followed by proclaiming the devil came here yesterday. But the president also got some backing yesterday, surprisingly, from Congressman Charlie Rangel, who said this.
You don't come into my country, you don't come into my congressional district, and you don't condemn my president. If there's any criticism of President Bush, it should be restricted to Americans, whether they voted for him or not. And I just want to make it abundantly clear to Hugo Chavez or any other president, don't come to the United States and think, because we have problems with our president, that any foreigner can come to our country and not think that Americans do not feel offended when you offend our chief of state.
Joe, you know, Charlie Rangel has not necessarily been known as a huge fan of President Bush. Why do you think he made these statements?
Well, you know, Charlie Rangel is definitely a very proud American, a proud Korean War veteran, and he stands up for his country. I think, though, that as I'm sure you realize, the United Nations is considered international territory. Mm-hmm. It happens to be in the United States, but it's considered international territory. I don't think that Charlie Rangel, while he certainly has a right to condemn whatever he wants in terms of what's said there, would want to be in a position of saying that international leaders can only say A, B, or C and can't say X, Y, and Z when they are addressing a forum at the United Nations. Now, clearly, the remark by Chavez took a lot of people by surprise, even people who are critical of the United States. And certainly in the United States Congress, few people can be more critical of George Bush than Charlie Rangel. There's no question about that. But at the same time, I doubt very much that he would want to restrict the right of anybody, any world leader to say what they think at an international place, which is the United Nations.
Professor Barry, what about the applause? Apparently, according to news reports, there was sustained applause for all of these remarks about George Bush as the devil. What does that say about our relationship to the rest of the world right now?
Well, it says what the Pew opinion poll research shows us about what people around the world think of us. People around the world, by and large, like America, and they want to come here. They can. move here if they can. In most places, not the French, they'd rather stay at home and eat croissant and drink.
The cheese is very good there,
but they want to move it. But they don't like our government and they don't like our policies, and they think we behave inimical to our values. And Chavez, while he was criticizing Bush, and they liked that, the people who applauded, he was funny too, and they liked that. So that he was bashing and he was saying things that they wished they could say, but they didn't feel they were operating from a position of weakness. They don't have oil or power or the volubility. And so he was saying what reflected what they thought. And so that's why they were applauding. And besides, he was less boring than the president of Iran, who was kind of boring.
I guess it's a popularity contest. Glenn, what do you make of all of this?
Well, no, it's not a popularity contest. The United States is unpopular in the world, many places, because of the things that we are doing in the world in many places. The war in Iraq is unpopular in many places in the world. It looks like unilateral, high-handed preemption, which is what it was. The war in Lebanon is unpopular in many places in the world. Our unvariable support for Israel up and down the line is unpopular. Many places in the world where people see the plight of the Palestinians. So while Hugo Chavez was vituperative and incendiary and disrespectful in the way in which he referred to the President of the United States, he nevertheless was articulating a critique which is very widely held by peoples in the world. And the question is whether or not we're just going to be so arrogant that we're not going to listen to that critique and try to think about what we're doing as a country that is really ultimately redounding against our interests by alienating people who really ought to be our allies and what we need to accomplish together in this world.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. And I just want to say vituperative, a good SAT word for all of our listeners under the age of 18. We've been talking with, in Providence, Rhode Island, Glenn Lowry, professor of social sciences and professor of economics at Brown University in Washington, D.C., Joe Davidson, editor at The Washington Post, and Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. She joined us by phone. And as always, if you'd like to comment on any of the topics you've heard on our roundtable, you can call us at 202-408-3330. That's 202-408-3330. Or you can send an email, log on to npr.org, contact us, and be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. Thanks to all our guests. And next on News and Notes, few people know about the 1906 Atlanta race riot that left dozens of African Americans dead. Now some city residents are working to bring this long-forgotten history to light. Plus, Archbishop Desmond Tutu celebrates a milestone.